Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We did see periods of returning interest rates higher, had to back off, and growth slowed with trade dispute. That recession was driven by COVID, not so much interest rates. But, you know, I just want to highlight that where we are recently, you know, we've had a 5 percentage point increase in inflation since March of 22. This is the highest rates we've had going back since the financial crisis, and also the biggest change in interest rates that we've had going back in several generations. So a lot of concern about a recession.
John Devine is chief economist with Cotton Incorporated.
In the U.S., we haven't technically gone into a recession, at least not yet. But, you know, retailers and brands, when they're looking at the outlook, when they're placing their orders, they are looking at this chart, you know, easily, such as the same one that we've got. And, you know, you can see their concerns about a significant pullback from the consumer front. And they have been conservative in terms of their order placement because of that.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
China has not bought up a bunch of American farmland yet. They bought up some, but it's relatively modest so far. I don't want to be a fearmonger, but the reality is that over the last 10 years, China has increased their holdings of farmland outside of China by 1,000%.
Representative Dusty Johnson from South Dakota is a member of the House Ag Committee.
Now, it's largely in the global south. Think South America, think Africa. But we have had expert after expert show up before our committee, the Select Committee on China, and tell us that China has a plan to develop more control over the American food supply. We cannot sleepwalk through this threat. The best time to shut the barn door is before the cattle are out. And that's why I was so glad that we passed my bill along with Dan Newhouse that would actually make it much harder for the Chinese Communist Party to buy American farmland.
And he also admits it's not just the Chinese buying up land.
All of us who are country mice had a granddad who told us that land is the one thing they're not making any more of. And yeah, it's not just China that has an interest in American farmland. The bills that I've been working on generally single out our adversaries. So North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China. You know, there are times foreign investment can be great. I mean, if Toyota wants to build another car factory in Tennessee, if they want to hire 1,000 American welders and machinists, that makes America stronger. But when the Chinese Communist Party or the North Koreans want to buy American farmland, we just need to say no.
There's also the issue of drones.
Yeah, we've also had lots of experts come before our committee and tell us that China is the expert at using information and using data to undermine American society. And we figured out they were doing that with Huawei in our telecommunication systems. We figured out that they've done that with software and the cranes that run American ports. We figured out they were doing it with TikTok, which is why I tried to lead the charge in making the Chinese Communist Party sell off TikTok. They are absolutely doing it with drones, and they are absolutely doing it with purchasing American farmland as well, next to key military installations. There is no way that the Chinese Communist Party would let the American government buy farmland close to sensitive Chinese installations inside China. That's just one of many reasons why we need to wake up to this threat.
Have you ever heard of LIDAR?
People know radar. People know sonar. LIDAR is far more advanced. It really paints a three-dimensional picture of how things interact and move together. It is really detailed information. And we know that China is the world's primary seller, manufacturer, developer of LIDAR technology. And there are lots of national security reports that say, gosh, actually, all of this information, if it's accessed by the Chinese Communist Party, could be really problematic. They know how our sensitive military installations, how our airports, how our other critical infrastructure, how it works and how it fits together. That's why I introduced a bill just a few days ago that would make it clear that our federal government has got to look to other places to buy this LIDAR technology. We should not be giving that money to our enemies and buying their LIDAR products.
But he remains optimistic.
I think we've got a real opportunity to right-size the federal government. I mean, in the last 4 years, we have increased the cost of regulatory compliance to the average American household by $47,000. We just keep layering on more rules and more rules and more rules, and I think people are getting sick and tired of it. And in the same way that I think we could get a real big breakthrough on the border and a real big breakthrough on government spending because people are frustrated, I think we're real close to getting people on both sides of the aisle step forward and saying, you know what, we've got enough regulations.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
First and foremost, when you think about when we're asking that cow to do things for us that dictate her productivity, is how well is that matched to what the environment's providing?
Dr. Jason Smith is a beef cattle specialist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension in Amarillo.
So are we matching our calving season to forage resource availability? Beyond that, as we go into the fall and winter, and most of us are going to be in a spring calving scenario, we have cattle that are right now, or once we wean calves, are going to be at a low point in their nutrient requirements, and that's an opportunity for us to build back some body condition in that female so that when she calves this spring, she's in a state or in a condition that will favor her not only raising that calf, but getting bred back in a timely fashion. And so I want to encourage people to be mindful of body condition right now. And once, you know, we wean calves, we've got some time where we can make some change in a female to put her back in a state where she's going to hopefully be productive for us. Certainly have to be mindful of economics in doing that. And we can certainly feed almost all of them to be productive, but it may cost us too much to justify doing that. So we've got to find that optimum balance there. But being mindful of that, being strategic with our supplementation decisions, making value-based decisions, so cost per unit of nutrient. We want to essentially fill the void that's left by whether it's grazed forage or hay that we're feeding with the most economical sources of protein and energy possible. So certainly be mindful of that as people are thinking about contracting supplement for the winter and some of those things. So encourage people, don't forget about the mineral nutrition and vitamin nutrition as we're going to be going into, you know, we've had grasses harden up quite a bit recently. And regardless of that, we'll be going into a season where unless we're grazing some wheat pasture or something like that, a large portion of our forages are going to go dormant. And so they're going to be relatively low in mineral content, almost void in terms of their fat-soluble vitamin content. So vitamin A is an example. Those are things we need to be thinking of and make sure that we're doing our due diligence in giving that female an opportunity to continue to be productive for us.
When it comes to testing inputs, you probably test forage, but do you test your water?
Well, you know, we don't, arguably as an industry, we don't spend as much time as we should focusing on water, but it is the most important nutrient. And it is not uncommon for there to be issues related to water quality. We often think about water quantity, but not as much about water quality. And especially in situations where our surface water, so our dirt tanks, if they've dropped down in level, whether it's because they've been drank or they've dehydrated because of drought, what we often see is this concentration of the things other than water in there. And in certain situations, those can become problematic for cattle. And so I do recommend, whether it's we're turning into a pasture for the first time in a while, or we're going to be potentially using a new water source, recommend some water analysis to first and foremost ensure that it's safe for cattle to drink. And then if not, working with somebody to troubleshoot what the options might be to alleviate the issue or find out or identify that as an unsuitable water source for the animal.
And do you invest back into the operation?
The feedback has been incredibly positive. The average producer that's gone through the Texas BQA program has rated the program favorably in terms of the information that they've got, the knowledge that they receive from participating in it. But they've also, on average, expected financial benefit directly to their operation from information gained from the program.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think this is a very important issue because, as Senator Frist said, we now have the science, and the science and the data are clear that we can solve this chronic disease epidemic by focusing on its root causes.
At a recent House Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing on investing in a healthy America, Dr. Mark Hyman.
I practice root cause medicine. Some people call it functional medicine, systems medicine, network medicine. It doesn't matter. The key is, what is the root cause? In America, we mop up the floor while the sink overflows. How do we turn off the faucet so we deal with the root cause of the problem, which is the food that's driving the chronic disease epidemic? And I think there's a lot of levers that government can pull. Many of them were mentioned here by the panel. I think a deep understanding of food as medicine is very important. I think most people still don't comprehend that food is not only something that can be used for prevention of disease, but for the treatment of disease. and that it often is a better treatment than medication. Medication has a role. It's important. It's not that we want to get rid of it, but we have to understand what is the actual right treatment for a patient. Just like this patient, Janet from Ohio, she lost 116 pounds and reversed all her diseases. This is not something that you could do with medication. She was already getting the best medication from the best healthcare system in the world, and yet she wasn't getting better. And I've seen this over and over in clinical practice. We've demonstrated this in our research at Cleveland Clinic. There's many, many data points that we have in the scientific literature that by applying the science of food as medicine, that we can transform biology. And for those of you trying to understand what does that mean, what does food as medicine mean, it's not just a metaphor. Food is literally a code that you're eating. Every molecule in the food you're eating translates into changes in your biology, in your gene expression, your immune system, your brain chemistry, your microbiome, your hormones. They're all regulated by the molecules you eat. And if they're molecules that produce health, it creates health. If they're molecules that produce disease, you get sick. And primarily the molecules that we're eating in America are not actually food. Food, by the definition in the Webster's Dictionary, is something that promotes the growth and health of an organism. By definition, most of what America is eating, ultra-processed food, is not food. It actually does the opposite. It promotes disease. So I think understanding how do we make nutrition central to healthcare? How do we reimburse for it? And I say in my written testimony that we don't have evidence-based medicine. We have reimbursement-based medicine. How do we move to more evidence-based treatments? In fact, every professional association, American Heart Association, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Association, I mean from the NIH, the American Diabetes Association, all recommend lifestyle therapy as the first line therapy for treating high blood pressure, for diabetes, for heart disease, and yet it's not done in healthcare because it's not reimbursed. If tomorrow doctors were paid to do the right thing, not the thing which they get paid to do, this would change very quickly. So I think the medically tailored meals program, produce prescriptions, incentivizing nutrition services and payment services for physicians and healthcare is critical. I think reforming our medical education system. I think the federal government spends $17 billion for graduate medical education. None of it comes with any ties or recommendations for including nutrition services. I think some of the work we've done and you've done, Mr. Chairman, has helped change that. And the ACGME, the American College of Graduate Medical Education, is now going to provide nutrition competencies as part of their training. And I think that we have an opportunity to do some really bold things through CMMI and Medicare demonstration programs like a diabetes reversal program, which has never been done before.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think it's important to continue to talk about what this is, and more importantly, and I keep saying this, what it's not.
Ethan Lane is Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association on traceability.
This isn't an all-encompassing system that's going to build some kind of a dossier on a producer, right? There's not going to be a file somewhere that's starting to gauge emissions levels and build out all of this stuff. This is quick access information in the event of a disease outbreak that has the premise ID and the time and location of this specific class of cattle as they move. And that's it. So when we talk about data security, we talk about, gosh, what's possible with this data. What we want to make sure we're talking about is what USDA is not allowed to do with it, right? They're not allowed to dive into the computer systems of a state animal health official and get all this data and use it to build a matrix of emissions around the country. They're not allowed to use it to start to build cattle numbers and depopulate. We've heard that concern. Gosh, this is going to lead to us going the way of Ireland or somewhere. That just isn't a reality given what's the scope of this rule or USDA's authority or where the data resides. So it's important to kind of put those fears to bed and look, to be very blunt, there are, I think, a lot of folks who have found that talking about these things and misleading producers is good for business. It's good for membership in some of these organizations. It's good for clicks on social media. Scaring people is, it turns out, a fairly profitable enterprise. And we know that's happening in the cattle and beef industry right now with the onset of this rule. We do need to be absolutely careful and aware of what's happening here and make sure we defend our producers and their data privacy and security as USDA moves into this space. There is no question we need to be extremely vigilant there. But we also need to make sure we're separating reality of what's happening here from some of the scare tactics and the fear that's out there. This simply isn't a massive reorganization of how they're doing animal disease traceability. This is a change in the technology that's going into the ear tag. And that's going to make it more efficient for some folks that want to use it to get that data. It's going to eliminate, you know, transposing numbers when you're doing it by hand. But what it's not is you know, building a system to put producers out of business. Clearly, we work for cattle producers. We would have some significant problems there if that was the case.
He agrees all this started 21 years ago.
100%. Look, the cow that stole Christmas, right, in 2003, we talk about this all the time. And if you look at the run out after that event, we have the most desirable beef product on planet Earth. What American producers are producing right now is simply better than any other beef being produced anywhere in the world. Whatever market we go into, we are immediately the dominant protein in those markets. And because of that, we're a target for the international community. If we have a disease issue, if there's any crack right in the system that allows some of those other countries to shut us down, they very much are going to take advantage of that and do that. And at this point, you're talking about $10 billion to the U.S. beef supply chain. This is a massive economic impact. If we were to have an FMD outbreak on American soil today, it would be an immediate 72-hour ground stop on all cattle movements across the country, all cattle. So just that, given our experience in COVID and the Holcomb fire, we know that that would be a catastrophic impact to producers' bottom lines. But that's just the beginning of this challenge, because we then have the business of having to figure out how to demonstrate what parts of the herd are safe, unlock them, get them moving again, and then start to demonstrate to those foreign countries that we have a handle on this disease outbreak issue in the U.S. supply chain.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, I think one of the things that's exciting is where we are from a market standpoint. Cattle are valuable.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension beef cattle specialist in Amarillo, Dr. Jason Smith.
Fortunately, everything else is expensive too, right? But the cattle are valuable. I think for the foreseeable future, they're forecast to continue to be valuable until we start to see some change in inventory, replacement female retention, and rebuilding of the cow herd, which we really haven't seen to a large degree yet. So I think, barring some black swan event or normal up and downward movement and seasonality to the market, I think we have favorable cattle value market conditions to look forward to. We're right now, I think, in a better feed cost price situation than we have been in the not too distant past. So I think that's, from a supplementation standpoint, something that's positive. The thing I think we need to keep in mind long term moving forward from an industry standpoint is, if we look at the influencers of value and what cattle are worth, the major influencers, conceptually, it's pretty simple. It's supply and demand. We know what's happened with supply. We're at a low cow herd inventory, so we're fairly short on supply. That favors upward movement in the market without a huge change in demand, right? It's important that we maintain, but more importantly, grow demand over time for beef. If we want to, especially if we look as we're moving into or through a cattle cycle, to where we will get to a point where prices drop once inventory increases and there's more supply on the market, increasing demand is our means of minimizing that price drop, if that makes sense. And so that's something that's really important, because we're not the cheapest option. We haven't been the cheapest option for a long time. We have to be the best option moving forward in terms of eating quality and consumer experience. And that's something that is easy for us to lose sight of, especially if we're selling wean calves, or we're selling calves at weaning, and we're not participating in the other live animal portions of product development, is what it comes down to. And so the reality is, we're making food. It may just not be becoming food immediately, right? So we need to have the consumer in the back of our mind, because there are things that we do at the calf level, stick with the calf for the rest of its life, that influence quality, influence its value to a consumer. And so I want to encourage producers to keep that on their minds as we move forward, and how that might influence perception and demand. One area that I think we got a lot of opportunity to continue to embrace is beef quality assurance. And so if you're not familiar with that, reach out to your county agent. Ask about beef quality assurance. We'll be doing a number of BQA training and certification programs throughout the Panhandle and the rest of the state for the foreseeable future. But we're working on getting a number of those planned right now for the next year. So if that's something that interests you, if you don't already have a BQA certification, get with your county agent and let's find an opportunity to get you certified. It's been a very valuable program, a very well received program that's had a tremendous amount of impact on the industry because we spend a lot of time focusing on best management practices, things that influence quality and beef safety, but also impact the efficacy of what we do. Vaccine handling is an example of that. But do things to directly impact the operation through either increasing productivity or decreasing cost of production. So the feedback we've gotten has been that, one, it's a free program. As far as I know, the foreseeable future will continue to be a free program that is expected to put money back in producers' pockets.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Brazil is now into cotton, and they are expanding their acres.
Luis Barbera is a partner with VLM Commodities on the biggest challenge and opportunity for cotton.
They're not as price sensitive as we are. Their cost of production is significantly lower. Their yield is somewhere over 4 bales an acre, and their production is somewhere between 5.59 and 62 cents at that yield. And on good years, it may be more. So we are behind the eight ball in that respect for most of the dryland farmers. Two, Australia. Australia is expanding their acreage. Their cost is probably even lower because they yield so much higher. We have to learn that our harvest window is no longer 2 months. It's not September, October, October, November, as we usually had it. It's now 6 months long because you're going to have Brazil harvesting before us and after us, and they are going to be hedging at favorable levels when the typical U.S. farmer is not used to it. I understand that the dryland farmer in West Texas is not going to be able to hedge his production because he's not sure if he's going to have production. For the rest of the United States, they have to move their anticipation of when their hedge window is. And what I mean by that is you cannot wait until harvest. You just don't have that luxury anymore. Some years it may work. This year it didn't. A lot of the crops that we're seeing are being hedged well in advance. In our last trip to Texas, we had the chance to teach in the school, as we said. There were some larger growers from Brazil there, and I was trying to pin down to them how they differ on the hedging from the United States. When they buy inputs for the next year's crop, they will hedge a certain amount of their expected production. They will also hedge their currency right away on that expected production. So when you think about that, if they bought their inputs in the beginning of the year when December was trading somewhere between 85 and 83 cents and they were able to hedge, what advantage do they have on hedging 30% of their expected production, 40% of their expected production? You could see it already in the December 2025 contract. There has been an overwhelmingly large amount of option activity selling upside calls. That is your Brazilian hedging. You've seen it in the July 25, December 25 future spread. That's most likely your Australian hedging. They're getting to hedge next year's crop at 72 cents and 75 cents, respectively. There's something to be said for that. A dryland farmer is at a disadvantage. He most certainly is. I'm not saying it's the way he should go. It's pure gambling for a dryland farmer. But in the United States, the grower has to come to the realization that there is going to be competition going forward. Brazil is going to expand their acres next year by at least 7%, if not more. If they expanded their acres by their 7%, that would put them at an 18.25 million bale crop at trendline yield. That's hard to compete with if you're going to also get another 5 million bales out of Australia. World trade is only in the mid-40s. You know, 45 million bales, 42 million bales, depending on how you look at it. So you're going to have your production coming from over half of your production for world trade coming from two countries. So things have to change in the way the U.S. markets it. That's your challenge, and that's also your advantage because we're no longer going to have to shoulder the load for the world. That's going to be transferred to Brazil. Carry is going to be in the market for the foreseeable future, but we can use that to our advantage as well. It's all about learning how to change the hedge window that the producer in the United States is willing to do.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
For this next marketing year, soybean growers in the U.S. and actually around the world will be trying to successfully market those beans while dealing with
the combination of large global supplies and a big increase in the U.S. crop as well.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski says world soybean production will be up about 9% from a year ago. And here in the U.S., it looks like our farmers will be harvesting a crop 10% bigger than last year, a record large crop of just under 4.6 billion bushels.
So relatively abundant supplies of soybeans, and that's been putting some pressure on U.S. prices.
Downward pressure, of course. Right now, USDA projecting an average U.S. farm price $10.80 a bushel for this crop that's about to be harvested. That's a drop of $1.70 or 13.5% from this past marketing year. Gary Crawford, Washington.